is find, deliver, and install.
Good morning. Welcome to the Alternative Health Show with Dr. Fred Harvey. I'm Rob Lori. We're going to take your questions and your emails throughout the show. Fred practices functional medicine in Sarasota, and he drives up every other Monday to do this program. And Dr. Harvey, nice to see you. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Rob?
I'm good. It was a beautiful weekend, and now we're back to work. So the drive up was okay. No major
smooth
traffic
sailing
problems
until that intersection. What do you all locals call that I-4-275 interchange? There's a name for it, isn't it? Monster or something?
Yeah, they call the one downtown Malfunction Junction. Maybe that should be Malfunction Junction Junior.
Yeah, really.
So, okay, well, I'm glad you made it safely. You had sent me four items that we could talk about, and
yes,
I thought they were all fascinating. One was about gyms, one was about seniors and prescription drugs. One was about kratom,
however you say it.
And one was about autism. Let's start with the one about autism.
Okay.
Because it is fascinating. And last week on Thursday, we had a very interesting show about autism on Midpoint. But the headline in the story says, could treating gut bacteria help autism symptoms? And in the story, and I'll let you tell the story, that there's been a small study of 18 kids, and there's been at least some success in changing gut bacteria to help the symptoms of autism.
Indeed. And it's not just gut bacteria, but that's what they're talking about in this article. This article actually shows that a clinical study proved what I've already witnessed. Years ago, I haven't seen a lot of autistic kids recently, but years ago I was seeing a woman who had a child. I was not seeing her child, but she brought him to my office with her, and it was evident that he was having developmental problems, and he was having communication issues, didn't make eye contact, made funny noises, all the classical symptoms that you'd see in somebody with autism. And I suggested that we do a stool test. This was in 1999, and she just didn't get there. She was a real nice lady, and actually I bought a dog from her. She was had a kennel, and when I went to pick up the dog, her child was on the floor with all the puppies, exposed to parasites.
Mm-hmm.
And so 4 years later, she ended up calling me and asking me if I would see her child. I was in a different office at that point, and she had taken her kid to a local pediatrician, but she had ordered online a stool test, and the pediatrician had no idea what to do with it. And it turned out this child had dysbiosis, which is imbalance of the normal flora, the bacteria, also overgrowth of yeast, and two parasites. And so I suggested that we would treat all that, and he started talking 9 months later. Yes.
For the first time?
For the first time.
How old was he?
I think he was 5 at that point.
Wow. Now, this study says that a lot of kids who are autistic, and people should look it up for themselves. April 9th, the study was published in a journal called Scientific Reports. I'm not familiar with that journal. But
neither am I.
But the journal suggested that with maybe a fecal transplant, kids with autism can see some improvement. And the article says that a lot of people with autism have gastrointestinal problems.
Yes.
Is that true?
It is true. Many kids with autism seem to have irritable bowel, diarrhea, cramps, pains, and really they're difficult to treat unless you actually look at what's going on down there. And unfortunately, gastroenterology currently is not doing broad-based stool testing. They're just looking for the pathogens, the ones we know of that cause foodborne bacterial illness like Salmonella and Shigella and Campylobacter and E. coli. But this goes way beyond that, and we need to look at this broader base of organisms like the yeast. In my prior practice, before I discovered these broad-based stool tests, I would never look for yeast. It didn't occur to me that that would be something that would be valuable to look at. But what's really interesting is 83% of these children in the study were classified as having severe autistic symptoms. At the end of the study, only 17 were severe, 39% were mild to moderate, and 44% were below the cutoff for mild autism. It's really amazing.
Well, that's miraculous.
Yes, it is. Yeah. So, fecal transplant. Sounds really weird to people, putting somebody's poop inside your body, somebody that you don't know, but is a healthy person, has been screened for possibly fecally transmissible diseases like hepatitis and HIV. And so you're getting kind of a pristine biome. And unfortunately, many autistic kids have had way too many antibiotics, and they don't have much of a microbiome left. And so that needs to be replaced, and it's amazing what this will do and give the kids a boost.
All right, so people can look up the study for themselves in Scientific Reports. And we just went to WebMD, and the headline in WebMD last Friday was, "Could treating gut bacteria help autism symptoms?" So people can look that up for themselves.
Yes.
Dr. Fred Harvey is here. You're listening to WMNF and Tampa. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address, dj@wmnf.org. All right, let's move on to the topic of kratom or kratom.
Yes.
And this is again a WebMD article that you sent me. It says, according to the CDC, Americans are dying from kratom overdoses. I see shops now springing up selling kratom. What is kratom?
Kratom is an herb. It comes from the Far East. I think possibly Thailand is an origin, but essentially it is a psychoactive herb. It's in that category of the things that are sort of sedating. And calming. Other herbs in that group include kava, and even valerian, which is available readily here in America. The difference is that valerian may be sedating, but I've never heard of a serious adverse event with it. The kava, when it was really popular about 15, 20 years ago, did get some misuse, and I think there were some people that had some hallucinations with it, and so many companies backed off on it. I had it in a muscle-relaxing, calming formula from a company called Metagenics at one point, but they dropped that out of their formula, I think because of the possible risk. I don't think there's much there with the kava when used right. Possibly the same thing with kratom. However, my problem with kratom is it's become a drug of abuse. And it's also very addictive. I've had clients in my office that had used it as self-medication for anxiety, and they liked the feeling of that more than they liked getting rid of the anxiety using natural methods, and so they just kept using the kratom.
How do people take kratom or kratom?
I believe it's actually ingested, but I'm not really sure. I haven't used it myself. I just know this guy was ordering it on the internet and getting who knows what. Basically, 91 people have died from an overdose of kratom now. We don't know exactly its mechanism as far as, you know, studying it for what kind of adverse consequences there really are. But obviously, this is not something that is tolerated by everyone, and we're misusing it to some extent.
And according to this article on WebMD about kratom, that the hotlines for U.S. poison control find that calls involving kratom overdoses are soaring, rising 50-fold from 2011 to 2016. So it's a lot more readily available. A lot more people are using it. And now we know that 91 people have lost their lives in a recent 18-month period to kratom or kratom.
And it didn't take that many people to have death from ephedra to have that herb banned. I'm surprised that there hasn't been a federal action yet, because ephedra is no longer available for use in nutritional supplements because some really foolish people who wanted to get pumped up for bodybuilding did vast amounts of the stuff and had a heart attack.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a fine line between, you know, a fear of drug use. I mean, we went through the marijuana scare for 80 years in this country,
yes,
and now it's finally fading. But I don't think anybody ever died from marijuana overdose. But,
well, actually,
oh, okay. Talk about
there's an edge there too, and I think everybody needs to be aware of this. As these more potent substances become available, there is something called Rick Simpson oil. It's called distillate. It's super, super, super concentrated, 100% THC, and the recommended dosing is very high. to the point where you're basically sedated into a chair all day to supposedly treat cancer. Heard miracle stories, but don't know if it's real. You know, I just the testimony is out there. But the problem is, in recreational use, somebody who's naive to tetrahydrocannabinol can really be seriously affected by it. And there was a fellow who was 70 years old who had a history of a bypass surgery 4 years earlier who had never tried cannabis. He walked into a recreational store in Toronto and got a 90 milligram pop. And instead of taking five licks, he was like the owl on the Tootsie Pop commercial, and it took three licks and the pop was gone. And he got a super overdose, had hallucinations, nightmares, and a heart attack. He didn't die.
Yeah.
But it can happen, and we got to be really careful. This is a drug. Now that it's, instead of being an herb that people have consumed for millennia, it's now a drug, and it's super concentrated. And this is where we're looking at problems, taking a huge dose in a naive individual. So everybody needs to pay attention to recommendations from the doctor that's actually certifying and ordering, because this stuff is potent.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not like just simply smoking backyard-grown or homegrown marijuana from 50 years ago or 40 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah. The in quotes, Mexican dirt weed, the stuff that people, that Cheech and Chong went up in smoke with, that stuff was one-fifth the potency, or maybe one-eighth the potency of what we see today.
Yeah. All right. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address, dj@wmnf.org. Frank Knox is our phone producer today. I'm reminded of that Maureen Dowd column, the writer for the New York Times, who went to Colorado just after marijuana was legalized. And
oh,
she
yes.
was eating a brownie or something, and she ate the whole thing and had quite an episode. And she was not a fan of legalized marijuana after that because she had a psychotic reaction.
I completely agree with her. I think edibles are frightening. I watched one of my friends eat a whole cookie one time, and he, a Vietnam vet, had a PTSD reaction and was completely out of it for a whole night. And yes, I think that no one understands that there's that much of a dose in a brownie. I mean, how many people actually eat one bite of an Oreo when an Oreo is 150 milligrams that could kill somebody who's not naive to it? You're only supposed to eat a nibble. Who eats a nibble of an Oreo cookie?
Yeah, you eat the whole thing.
Yeah. So this is really dangerous if there are kids in the house, because they're going to see gummies and cookies and things like that. They're dangerous. This is not a good idea. I'm glad the Florida legislature has not allowed edibles.
All right. So we should take these, if we take this stuff, take it in small amounts.
Yes.
Yeah. Again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Alex writes, what should I eat and what supplements should I take to fix estrogen dominance? Any brands you can recommend? Any brand of multivitamin that you can recommend, writes Alex.
That's a great question. Estrogen dominance is the situation where it appears that your body has got more estrogen than progesterone. So estrogen is fat soluble. One of the things that you can do to get rid of estrogen from your body is to make sure you are eliminating it, and pooping three times a day does that. So fiber will help you move things through the body. Flax seed has a great fiber, but also has something called lignans in it, and the lignans help to prevent the improper metabolism of the estrogen. And so you'll keep it from going down into the most active form and keep it metabolizing into the place where you want it to be to get out of your body. And so any kind of flaxseed, ground, throw the tablespoon on your cereal in the morning, or mix it into your baked goods instead of one of the eggs. And anyway, you can get really, or just take flax oil. Barleen's flax oil with high lignin content is another thing that helps metabolize it. But the brassica vegetables are really good at eliminating estrogen. They have a chemical in them called sulforaphane. And sulforaphane causes your liver to excrete estrogen more effectively. And so if you do, Zymergen makes a brand called Oncoplex, which is a super concentrated broccoli sprout extract, which has essentially the equivalent of 8 pounds of broccoli in one capsule. This is a super stimulator for moving the estrogen through the body. And so is diindolmethane, DIM. there's also a combination called Hormone Protects that has the sulforaphane and the DIM in that one product. And if you throw some curcumin into that, you've even got more estrogen metabolism. There's so many good things to move it along.
Just backing up to the vegetables that you mentioned, what kind of vegetables did you say?
Brassica.
The
cruciferous are broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, arugula, Brussels sprouts, all the stinky sulfur vegetables.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Does that include onions and garlic?
Well, the sulfur in those does help too, but the sulforaphane chemical has a different property than the onion sulfur. But they're both good at detox. It's just that the brassica vegetables tweak the liver to actually specifically start a process that eliminates those.
Does your body naturally balance the estrogen? Once you begin to eliminate excess estrogen, does your body then take over and
yes.
put you back in balance?
Your body wants it to be in balance. It's when you eat the wrong things that promote the other estrogen. So if you eat too much saturated fat, too much sugar, not enough fiber, you're going to head down that pathway. But your body wants to keep it in balance. And if you're menstruating, then obviously you're going to have significant cycles of high estrogen and then high progesterone if everything's working well. If you have dysmenorrhea or bad periods, perimenstrual syndrome, then you probably have low progesterone relative to the estrogen. And it may even be helpful to get an over-the-counter progesterone cream and use that for the second half of the cycle. So counting from day one of your period, go 15 days out and use progesterone for a week or two. A little bit of cream on your body once a night may just actually get rid of the bad PMS. If that doesn't work, you need to talk to a doctor.
We're going to take some phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. And Dr. Fred Harvey is here, as he is every other Monday, giving us some medical advice. And we're going to go to Scott in Gulfport. Scott, you're on. What's your question?
Hi. I heard what to me was somewhat alarming statistic about kratom a few moments ago, about 92 deaths. And I'm just curious about the source of that information, because we had some legislation here within the last, 3 years, where a state senator was introducing a ban on kratom as a result of a single death that was attributed to kratom. But what was not discussed in her presentation was the fact that there were also psychiatric condition involved there, as well as some additional antidepressant drugs and a life occurrence. So the kratom happened to be there. So if there's 92 deaths, I really need to know that, because I'm a regular user. I'd also like to correct the record as far as pretty much common knowledge in any research you do on this product is that it starts as a very mild stimulant, and when you become too heavy of dosing is when it begins to have the sedating effect. It also will cause nausea in 99% of patients, which makes it self-regulating. So I need to know about where these 92 people died and how, please.
So actually, I am not sure the source of that. I got it from WebMD, I think, but I'm not sure the original published
Scott,
data.
It's really easy to find. Go to
WebMD, I can do that, and then I can find their source, because
exactly.
It sounds like highly suspect information from my experience and knowledge about it in that community. So I just caution everyone to do their homework before they make decisions.
Absolutely. Well, and their source on this, Scott, just so you know, is the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report.
Okay, well, CDC, right away, I'm sorry, but that, that's sort of right there with FDA in terms of credibility on these things.
So you think that credibility of government research of reported, which is mandatory, reported overdose deaths is inaccurate? I think it would be on the low end, to be honest.
Look at their information, but I can say that, for example, there was a recent case. There's the FDA. It turns out when this state legislature was attempting to criminalize kratom or ban it, it was discovered a few months prior to that a patent for the active ingredient, Mitragynia speciosa, I want to say, was applied for by a large drug company. So, yeah, there's some The CDC, I can't say for sure, but the FDA, yeah, there might be shenanigans.
Yeah, we're not quoting Scott, we're not quoting the FDA. We're quoting the CDC, which just basically gathers numbers.
They gather data.
And I'm going to look into that because I really do want to know about those if I'm a regular user, right?
So. Yeah, my opinion about kratom, though, or kratom overall, is that people shouldn't self-medicate. They really should actually seek the advice of a professional to help them figure out why it is they feel the need to self-medicate. Because there's probably an answer there that would actually solve the problem and then avoid any kind of complication from, like, a death from an overdose from a non-drug, possibly very dangerous herb like kratom.
Possibly, yes. And there are also urban drug interactions where we have Eastern doctors recommending things that go on top of what Western doctors are prescribing, and we don't necessarily each know about.
That's very true. That's actually something else that came up in my research this weekend, is that polypharmacy is a huge problem. Older Americans are using way too many drugs, and we need to address that one.
Well, we have a drug for the side effects of our drugs, and this is because we take them further and further from their original plant source and refine them, when indeed nature usually outsmarts us on these things.
That's very true.
Components to put in there to help buffer some of those side effects.
All right, so, Scott, thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call.
That wants to keep eating its McDonald's, and so they can take a cholesterol pill to solve.
Yeah, exactly.
They're happy to do that. All right, thank you for your time, and I'll be looking up that information.
All right, Scott, thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Layla writes this: I was wondering, doctor, do calories and fat matter? Other than sugars, what should we be looking at? Why should we reduce starches in conjunction with reducing sugars? I was just wondering if you could elaborate on this a little bit for us. From Sarasota, writes Layla.
So calories, fat, sugars, starch, all of them matter. So a balanced diet really does include all of those things. We're not going to be able to avoid sugar if we eat plants. All plants have sugar in them. And so it depends on how we get that sugar from them. Are we going to juice it out and drink a big glass of sugar juice, or are we going to eat it with the fiber that comes with it? That's really important, because the fiber delays the uptake of the sugars and blunts that effect on our blood so that we don't have sugar intolerance issues. Fat also delays the uptake of sugar, so it blunts that effect too, so it makes it a more smooth intake of your nutrients. The quality of the fat's really important. We need a modest amount of saturated fat, because we're animals and we have a saturated fat structure in our body. But we also need good monounsaturated fats, like from olive oil, and polyunsaturated fats like fish oil, and all these things go together to balance the system. We need them. We need protein to go with it too. And so if we're looking at weight loss, we want to eliminate simple sugar, and we want to eliminate excess fat, unless we really have a need to go to a ketogenic type diet. There are different ways to approach it, but really, we want to eliminate as much simple sugar from our diet as possible, because added sugar is problematic for us. When our country was founded, we consumed about 4 pounds of sugar per person annually. Now we consume about 145. That is killing America. It's why we have so many degenerative diseases.
So when you say simple sugar, that means the sugar that's on pastries and the sugar maybe in our soft drinks. Does it include, do you also include carbohydrates as, do you count that as a sugar?
No, so carbohydrates is a broad category. It has simple sugars, like processed sugar, like cane sugar we'd get in crystals, or honey, or maple syrup. All of these things are simple sugars, but maple syrup is more of a natural sugar. It's more easily tolerated by the body. Same thing with honey. But the sucrose in your table sugar is really hard on the body.
Mm-hmm. Really?
So, yeah.
It's hard on the body.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why we're having so much trouble with degenerative diseases, because in the 70s, when cholesterol became evil and fat became evil, the sugar industry put out a bunch of ridiculous research that was paid for by the sugar industry that showed how fabulous it is. And so we ended up on a sugar diet. And breast cancer and heart disease and Alzheimer's disease and all these things are on the rise, and we're eating this stuff.
Yeah, I was thinking more about processed carbohydrates like pasta and bread and that sort of thing.
Yes.
That you know, if you were to take, let's say, a pound of, you know, fatty salmon and a pound of bread,
mm-hmm.
which would contribute more to weight gain?
more likely the bread, if it's, you know, white wonder kind of bread, because those turn into sugar immediately upon chewing them. The amylase in your saliva turns the starch into sugar. And then that goes right into the system too. But there are resistant starches. Some of the more dense carbohydrates that you might find, say, in a potato or in a mango. The slick feeling of a mango is actually soluble fiber, which is a carbohydrate. Fiber is a carbohydrate. So the more fiber we eat, the healthier we are. The if we can get... if we go from a low fiber diet and go to a 35 gram a day fiber diet, we reduce the recurrence rate of prostate and breast cancer by 30% just by adding fiber diet. It's pretty amazing. And so that's a good carbohydrate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Our phone number 813-239-9663. And this is WMNF in Tampa. You're listening to the Alternative Health Program. And let's go to Bob in St. Petersburg. Bob, you're on with Dr. Fred Harvey.
Hello, doctor.
Hi, Bob.
Appreciate your time today. I am a kratom user. I had been on Oxycontin and morphine for over 10 years. And this past Christmas, I detoxed off pain medication by using kratom. Now, I understand that if you abuse it, just like any other drug, if you abuse it, it can probably be fatal. But I have a strict regimen. I use 10 to 15 grams a day, depending on my pain level. And I feel like I just went through a regimen of liver tests and cardio tests, and the kratom didn't even show up on those things.
Well, I don't think they're testing for kratom in your urine or anything at this point. And frankly, I really congratulate you on getting off the opiates. I think that's fantastic, and I'm glad you found a tool to do it. My reservations about it all is that we don't know enough about it. There now are 91 recorded deaths from it, and I think it needs to be studied more. I mean, we've been studying cannabis for millennia. Humans have been using it regularly across the planet for millennia, and it seems there's very low risk using it, and it seems that it can do pretty much the same thing that the kratom did for you in getting off opiates. And it can be controlled and directed, and we can look at milligram strengths and understand it. But I don't have a problem with actually kratom being studied and figure out how we can use it, but we're not there yet, and it's very concerning to me that self-medication is the way it's being used now and without any direction, and people are dying.
Well, people are dying from the other opioid drugs that they're giving people. Suboxone, for instance, is just as addicting as opioids.
I'm sorry, what is?
Suboxone.
Oh, well, that's another opiate. So I agree with you. People are using those too, but I think we have some really good data from the states that have already legalized medical cannabis that we're getting results in people reducing opioid doses and getting off of them, and we can control it, and we know what they're doing.
Right, but I use both. I use medical marijuana, but the kratom is much better at taking care of pain and cravings and all that. It just works for me.
Okay.
All right. Bob, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye. And here's an email from Bobby. Bobby writes, we happen to be out in Colorado when Maureen Dowd took the brownie with marijuana. And Bobby goes on to write, she knew she was eating candy bar that was 100 milligrams. This is not recommended. Just like your guns and meds, you lock them up so kids don't get to them. My two cents, by the way, she got her 5 minutes of fame. Actually, Maureen Dowd, a pretty famous writer, so she's still famous.
She got some infamy out of that one.
And then James writes this, I have a shoulder impingement syndrome, B, that causes a lot of pain. My orthopedist is hesitant to prescribe pain meds because I am on blood thinners. What do you recommend for pain, writes Jim?
Well, let's back that up a little bit. You have a shoulder impingement syndrome. I have had two. Over the last 3.5 years, I've worked out both of my rotator cuff problems with some partially torn ligaments and tendons. And I did it without pain medicine other than a bit of ibuprofen and something called Curafen, C-U-R-A-P-H-E-N. It's in a combination of curcumin and boswellia and natokinase and DL-phenylalanine, all of which help to change the pain pattern.
Spell that again for us.
C-U-R-A-P-H-E-N.
Okay.
You can find that one online. So The way I did it was by getting regular chiropractic adjustments and class 4 laser. Class 4 laser is a healing modality. It's not a cold laser. It's a hot laser, and it helps to rebuild your tendons. I took a supplement called Synovix Tendon and Ligament from Zymogen, which has really amazing research about reorganizing frayed tendons and rebuilding them. I took my regular supplement load of fish oil and multivitamin, all that stuff. Active Nutrients is my multivitamin. My fish oil is Omega Monopure. They're really important at maintaining structure. And I saw a practitioner of something called muscle activation technique. This is a personal training technique. It's not a physical therapist, but it's an amazing modality that evaluates your muscles in ways I've never had done by anybody else. And it changed the way I use my arms. And also, I had some amazing deep tissue muscle massage, which released some of the things in between time. I would go back and forth between these three practitioners every week. It gets rather expensive, but it got me out of it without any surgery, and my shoulders work again, and I'm not in pain.
When you have a shoulder impingement, is that identified through an x-ray? How do you identify that you've got this condition?
Well, actually, the easiest way to identify it is by moving your shoulder and realizing you can't. Then you know you're there.
You were unable to lift your hand above maybe the top of your shoulder, right?
I couldn't even lift my left hand 3.5 years ago above my waist without having pain. My right hand wasn't quite as bad, but it had a different kind of restriction in the rotation. But both are now full range of motion.
Yeah, you do have full motion range. I can attest to that because you've been demonstrating this ever since I met you. Dr. Fred Harvey is here. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. And let's go back to the phones. We're going to go to Jay in Sarasota. Jay, you're on. What would you like to ask Dr. Harvey?
Dr. Harvey, I'm curious about how they regulated alcohol to keep it from killing people, because the levels of proof are one of the ways. And the other discussion I'd like you to get into is I was taking statin drugs, and I looked it up, and I realized some years ago that statin drugs are harmful to muscles. And, of course, I told the doctor, there was a specialist, that, isn't the heart a muscle? And his retort was, well, it's all we've got. So I just like your comment. I'll go off there and listen. Thanks.
Okay. All right, Jay, thank you.
So alcohol. They can't regulate alcohol so it doesn't kill people. That's what alcohol does. It's a poison. It's a toxin. It seems to make us feel better. It seems to have some mild potential benefit in maybe reducing a heart attack. But most of that washes out when you go beyond 1 ounce a day, and definitely when you go beyond 2. The risk-benefit ratio is risk, not benefit. It causes problems across the board. And so the only reason we don't regulate alcohol is because we created a huge criminal black market when it was banned. Now we just control it, sort of regulate it. Basically, we tax it. And unfortunately, we don't put those tax dollars directly into addiction treatment. We put them into the general budget, which is stupid. Same thing for the cigarettes. That tax should go into Medicare to cover the respirators and the heart attacks, because that's what it's done. And so people are still dying from alcohol, and we just need to think of it as a toxin and use it really judiciously.
I think Jay was asking, how do we figure out that 12 ounces of beer or 6 ounces of wine or 4 ounces of hard drink, that was kind of safe? But beyond that, once you get to 2 drinks or 3 drinks or 4 drinks, then you're getting into trouble.
For years, we've known that we're just watching blood pressure. If someone is sensitive to alcohol, at 2 drinks, you're at your limit, essentially. You go to 3 drinks and you see the blood pressure start to go up exponentially. So if you get to 4 drinks and you're alcohol sensitive, you could be running around with a pressure of like 190 over 110, ready to explode because of what it does to the system.
Yeah.
And so I think we just agreed that, you know, a bottle of beer, we measured it. It's obviously a bottle of beer has the equivalent of a 4 to 5 ounce glass of wine is the equivalent of 1 shot of hard liquor, unless your hard liquor is grain, and then it's 100%. So that most of the alcohol is hovering around 50% alcohol in the bottle, and so they realized that those were equivalent doses, and people seemed to tolerate them without dying on a regular basis.
Here's an email, anonymous. They say, does your doctor see gummy vitamins as dangerous? Are childproof caps insufficient for marijuana-based medicines? What do you think about gummy vitamins? I guess he's saying he's talking about gummy vitamins, not gummy marijuana.
Right, right. I think the gummy vitamins thing is an issue. If kids really like it, when I was a kid, we had Flintstones vitamins. They might have been colorful, and they might have had fruit flavors, but boy, were they terrible tasting. I don't think any kid ever would ever want to eat a whole bottle of Flintstones vitamins. They tasted like B vitamins. These new gummies, they've actually reduced the amount of B vitamins in them, and they don't taste that badly. In fact, there's a Omega gummy that one of the companies makes, I think Nordic. It's delicious. Tangerine little fishies that have, unfortunately, some cane sugar in, but it's a good way to get some fish oil into a kid who doesn't want to take fish oil. But yes, they need to be actually protected. They need to be out of the kids' reach, and they need to have childproof caps, I believe, because you could overdose. But you'd have to eat a whole bottle to get very bad, and most of the time, those vitamins have so little in for kids that they're not going to get that much risk. But and childproof for marijuana-based medicines is the other part of her question, and I totally agree with that.
We're going to go back to the phones, and we're talking about health here on WMNF in Tampa. Let's go to Fred in St. Pete. Hi, Fred. You're on with Dr. Fred Harvey.
Good morning, Rob, and thanks for everything you do for the station. And, Doctor, thanks for your contribution to such a great show.
Glad to help.
Just kind of a general question. I have a family member, young 30 female, who was just diagnosed with Crohn's in the last year. And just wanted to get your thoughts, advice, opinion on that. Kind of an open-ended question. I'll listen offline.
So you're asking about Crohn's, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
All right, Fred, thanks.
Yep.
So Crohn's disease is, I think, a spectrum illness, as are all the colitis-type problems. Crohn's is a disease where your immune system is attacking the lining of your small intestine. And so it seems that there are food triggers and stress triggers, and your microbiome would be altered by both of those things. So the microbiome is really crucially involved here. So my approach to it is we do stool testing. We do some food sensitivity testing, or if we don't want to spend the money on food sensitivity testing, just go gluten, dairy, and egg free for a bit. Take out the three major irritant proteins, really active as far as promoting immune reaction. So gluten, dairy, eggs, cut them out, see how you do. Maybe even cut out any kind of alcohol that has yeast in it. So no beer and no wine, and no fermented products like vinegar, because the yeast product could be also an irritant there. It gets to be a real strict, clean diet, like the autoimmune protocol diet, AIP. You can look that up online. It's basically no dairy, no grains, and they put no beans on that diet. But I think that the eggs are more important in this case than the beans. However, we may find out that the beans could be a problem later on down the line, too.
Why would your body attack itself?
Yeah, that's a good question. So our genetics are set up with certain signals that are based on our long history. One of those genes, APOE, is one that's left over from our 200, 300, 400,000 years ago in our evolution, and it's a very aggressive immune gene. And it was basically needed when we were walking barefoot across the Serengeti and getting tetanus in our foot. We needed something to attack immediately so we wouldn't die. But we have so little of that now that gene, when we can carry it, actually is so overactive that it causes things like heart attack and Alzheimer's. And so there's another gene, though I don't know what it is, and I don't think we've laid that out yet in medical understanding, is there's some gene that's doing that with the Crohn's and with ulcerative colitis and with lymphocytic colitis, all of them. There's a gene for celiac, the HLA, DQB, DQ2, and DQ8. Those are the genes that would predispose you to having autoimmunity, your body attacking yourself simply by eating wheat.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make sense, but we do it.
So in Crohn's disease, figuring out what triggers this autoimmune response, that's the key.
It really is, because we can't fix the antecedent because it's in our body. And so we have to go to the trigger and find out which triggers are there and then eliminate them. I have a patient with the problem. It took us 2 years to get him to flares, no exacerbations, because his partner is an amazing chef and he loves tiramisu, and every quarter he would go face first into a bowl of tiramisu and have red wine with it. And both of those are triggers for his problem.
Yeah.
And so I finally convinced him the last time, because he went face down in the tiramisu. We did a test of his inflammation in his gut, and we got the result back when he called me and said, I'm having a flare. And the result showed that he was going to have a flare. It was predicted, so he got it. He saw the actual evidence that he triggered his flare. And he said, okay, I'm done. And it's pretty amazing. He's been great for a year since then.
We're going to go to Al in St. Petersburg, who has a question on the phone. Al, you're on WMNF with Dr. Fred Harvey.
Yeah, I just had a question, being I'm diabetic, as far as I've been told the sourdough bread and rye are, I guess, something that you can eat as far as having diabetes, not, going to be negative to your health.
That's a good question. And whole grains are much better when you have diabetes, because the whole grains delay the uptake of the sugar from your gut, so you don't get quite as much of a burden to have to metabolize when you don't metabolize sugar effectively and efficiently. And so those are good. But if you're not controlled, if your hemoglobin A1C is still in the sixes, high sixes, seven, something like that, and you want to get it down into the fives where you're really safe, then I would get rid of carbohydrates completely, except for vegetables and some berries, until you get that under control. Because the addition of the bread makes it much harder for you to get that control.
Okay. Very good.
Okay,
glad to help.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah,
I understand. It's hard. It's hard. Bread tastes so good, so it's hard to, you know, go from the delicious taste of bread to all vegetables.
Yes, it really is. It's so hard. But there could be some alternative breads. If you're willing to step out of the whole grains and go into paleo breads, almond bread, coconut bread, these things are actually pretty tasty, and they have higher fat, higher protein, and higher fiber, and they're not basically a grain carbohydrate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, or you could go, there's a lot of vegan restaurants out there, too, that have substitutes for bread.
Very true.
Yeah. This is WMNF in Tampa. Liz writes this: while I agree that edibles have the potential to be dangerous to naive users, you highlight the need for education and also research about cannabis. The drug companies can advertise drugs on television and in magazines and newspapers to go ask your doctor about this or that medicine. Everyone has a responsibility to understand the medications they are taking. Edibles are a viable route for getting treatment. It is possible for you to make your own edibles from concentrate that are very specifically dosed by milligrams of CBD and THC. They should be stored in your freezer and clearly marked of how much they contain so that no one accidentally eats them. This is the second time I've heard Dr. Harvey speak out against edibles. I would hope that he would continue educating himself, writes Liz, in advocating for the safe use of edibles and to stop demonizing them in general, writes Liz. Okay, your challenge there, Fred.
Yes, well, thank you. I am educated in the use of edibles and in the use of CBD, THC. I'm a certifying doctor. The problem is, doctors, I've educated myself. The state has provided no education. The medical marijuana companies provide education to sell a product. And in fact, they provide education to the client in the store to sell more product. Their goal is to sell product. This is not about safety. This is about making profit. So you have to remember that if you're going to try to educate yourself, you need to spend a lot of time doing it, because they're not going to help you. The state doesn't help doctors. The doctors go into this clueless, because the state educates the doctor in how to use the system only, not what to prescribe, how to prescribe it. There is absolutely no assistance whatsoever from state sources or really from the salespeople, because the salespeople have generic information, but they don't have specifics on therapy. And edibles are dangerous when in the hands of the public, we already know. I'm not trying to demonize them. I'm trying to make people aware that this is a significant issue.
Because you're not anti-marijuana.
Not at all. And I think that the edibles could be fine, but they are dangerous when they're just left around. The 70-year-old guy that walked in and the head shop salesperson did not tell him that he should only take five licks. There was no education. So you're basically looking at the frontier here, the wild, wild west. I would say stand your ground and don't eat one until you know exactly what it is. I don't trust them because nobody's getting the education. You sound like you're educated, Liz, and I'm glad you are, but it is possibly a viable route for treatment, but you have to do it with someone who is understanding how to use them.
Let's go back to the phones. We're going to go to Stuart in Tampa. Stuart, you're on WMNF with Dr. Fred Harvey.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. A similar subject that you were just on is a condition is ulcerative colitis. And over my lifetime, I used to eat big salads, raw vegetables. And since I've had this condition, I've started steaming my vegetables, and my flare-ups are a lot less intense. So it's been a big help, presumably because I'm getting less fiber. However, I'm wondering if by steaming my vegetables, I'm missing some nutrients that I got when I was eating raw vegetables, and if there's something I can do about that, if so.
Good question. I think your choice to steam the vegetables does take a burden off the system. Some people don't do really well with large quantities of raw vegetables. And so it may be best that you do steam them. It was an interesting email that came in. Just to add to this, David suggested that we don't cook the brassica vegetables because the enzyme in the vegetable will be destroyed that turns it into an active substance. And that may be the case, but we have a microbiome in our gut that actually changes glucoraphanin, which is the actual chemical, into sulforaphane, which is active. And so we need our microbiome to do that. And so if we do lightly steam them, we're not going to destroy all the glucoraphanin. It'll get to our belly, and our probiotics, our good flora, are going to turn it into sulforaphane. So yes, it's a good point. Don't overcook vegetables, but cook them because you can release more of the nutrients out of them. Fascinating study with broccoli a couple of years ago showed that if you boil broccoli, you have the lowest amount of nutrients. If you steam broccoli, you have a better amount of nutrients. But if you microwave broccoli, you have the most amount of nutrients because you use the least amount of water to heat the vegetable to its core, and then you don't steam out all the good nutrients.
But you still get the less fiber and hence the less reaction.
Yes, because you break down the cellulose a little bit. You still get fiber, but you break it down so that the cell walls are broken and you can actually get the nutrients out and chew it easier and absorb it easier.
So am I getting the same amount of fiber whether I steam or whether I eat raw?
Yes, you're just losing a couple of the antioxidants.
Okay, but it's still easier on the gut that way.
Yes. Yep. So I'm fine with you steaming your vegetables. I think it's great.
Okay, great. All right, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, Stuart, thanks a lot. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. This is the Alternative Health Program, which is on every other Monday at 10 o'clock. And let's go to Chuck in Clearwater. Chuck, do you have a question?
Question, kind of comment. I make edibles, and I hand them out to cancer patients in my neighborhood who can't afford them. And one of the things that I tell them is, I tell them the dosage, what I prepared it at, so on and so forth, and tell them what they should try initially. And if at any time they feel that it's too much, they need to drink some grapefruit juice, because the grapefruit juice will disconnect the cannabinoid receptors, just like a lot of other medicines that are out there. And so far, anybody that's had an issue, when they drink the grapefruit juice, takes care of it real quick.
Chuck, how much marijuana do you put in your edibles?
It depends. What I try to do is I try to stick around 29 milligrams per serving.
Okay.
I break it out into what I look up and see what the rating is on that particular. What I've been told is a brand of cannabis. And then whatever that rating is at, that's usually a range. So I average it. And then I decarb it. And after I decarb it, I infuse it into different things. And then I take the measurements off of there, what it should have been from the initial, and then how many servings that are based, then gives me the milligrams per dosage.
So it doesn't sound like a big dose for someone who's experienced with it. It's still a large dose for someone who's naive. And so I think you're a generous, good soul. You're walking a tightrope here in Florida, but keep up the good work. In the meantime, though, I really think that it's much easier for people to dose with the sublingual tincture, because then you know exactly what you're getting per drop, and then you can titrate your dose drop by drop by drop to the point where you get the effect. I have one guy that used 1-to-1 CBD to THC for neuropathy in his feet that it came from chemotherapy, which is now a year over and still the neuropathy's there, and he's using 3 drops twice a day, and he has
that's all he needs.
That's all he uses. Yeah. And so he found out that he didn't need to do high doses because he's completely naive to it. So I'm just concerned that the high doses in most edibles are risky for most people who are naive to it.
If I could interject, I totally agree. My big point that I wanted to make is use of grapefruit juice to counteract it.
That's really interesting, and I need to look that one up. I've never heard of it before. But the other thing that can work is CBD. If you had a good quality full-spectrum CBD and you do CBD, it does blunt the effect of the THC that's making people feel weird.
Chuck, I seem to remember back in the day, people that were using LSD would take vitamin C to get quickly out of the trip.
You must have had some weak LSD because I didn't have that.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm just speaking. I know this secondhand. I don't know this firsthand.
All right. Okay. My apologies for the humor there.
No, it was fine. It was fine. All right, Chuck. Thanks a lot.
All right, bye.
Thanks. Good to hear from you. And Gina writes this. This is my situation 10 years ago. I had extremely degenerative osteoarthritis, TMJ, very severely degeneratively osteoarthritic with subchondral cystic erosion plus thinning of the condyles. I'm skipping over some to shorten. This was what an MRI found 10 years ago, but it was never communicated to me, though it would have been a surprise. Would not have been a surprise. What can you suggest?
Well, that's a tough one, because if it's that old, how is it today and what's going on is the question. But in general, osteoarthritis responds to actually work. Here's an interesting thing. Exercise, appropriate exercise, actually fixes a lot of joint pain. And it's likely that you have degenerative joint in your temporomandibular joint, your jaw joint, because your muscles were tight or your teeth were off and you were actually doing some grinding the wrong way. So I have actually had some TMJ problems in my past, and what fixed it actually, the dentist had recommended that I get some tooth grinding. They would plane it down so that everything would fit. But I went to my deep tissue massage therapist and had the muscular problems around my jaw fixed, and then my teeth fit the normal way, and I didn't have to have any teeth grinding work done by the dentist, because that would alter me permanently into a way that it wasn't good, because it was my muscles that were doing it.
Yeah.
So fish oil, glucosamine chondroitin, maybe some Curafen, which I mentioned earlier, all these things for the joint health, and then get some deep facial massage. It's painful, but it's worth it.
Tom has a really big question, and we only have about 2 minutes to go. Tom says, my wife has multiple myeloma and has pretty much destroyed her kidneys. She's on dialysis 3 days a week with no end in sight. Is there anything that you can suggest to help heal the kidneys?
This is a really difficult problem, because multiple myeloma is a blood cancer that produces way too much excess protein of one type that when filtered through the kidney, it gets stuck. And so the little filtering apparatus, the glomerulus, gets filled with goo, like mucus, that just stays there. And I know of no real definitive action you can do, with the exception of possibly proteolytic enzymes. Zymogen makes one called proteozyme, and what it does is dissolve proteins. And it may work to take a large dose of that, 2 or 3 times a day, to start moving enzymes through the body to help clean it out. But this is a tough situation. And the only answer when they're that junked up is, like your wife has found, is dialysis. So maybe enzymes.
All right. And then we have time maybe for this. Do kids need a multivitamin? That's from Layla.
Oh, I think kids really could benefit from a multivitamin. There are some good ones. Zymogen makes a powdered multivitamin that has virtually no bad flavor. You can mix it into some water, juice, or whatever the kid's drinking for the morning and see if it can go down that way. And There are also some gummies out there that are good, but I like the powder because it tastes like juice, and they're really usually willing to drink it.
And do kids need a multivitamin if they're getting a well-rounded diet?
I think everybody needs a multivitamin on this planet because our food practices, our agriculture practices have depleted the nutrients in the soil, and even organic vegetables don't have the minerals they did 100 years ago.
Okay. Well, Dr. Fred Harvey, thanks a lot for spending another hour with us. Good to see you, Fred.
Glad to be here.
So we'll see you in 2 weeks?
Definitely.
All right. Dr. Fred Harvey has been here for the last hour, and he will return in 2 weeks in this time slot at 10 a.m. on a Monday morning. Next week in this time slot, you'll hear Tanya and John on the Sustainable Living Program. This is 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg. Coming up at 12 noon today on the Midpoint Program, Sean Canan is going to have a guest on speaking about the environmental issues that are before the Florida legislature. The legislature is still meeting in Tallahassee. It's got another 3 weeks to go, and there are some significant environmental issues being discussed, and that's what's coming up at 12 noon today right here on WMNF in Tampa. In the next hour, radioactivity, and we'll hear Florida this week, among other things. But before we do that, here's the news from NPR.